This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. British filmmaker Ali Lambert spent 5 weeks in Syria last fall documenting the country's civil war. He spent time with rebels, refugees, and soldiers loyal to the regime, and his new film, Syria Behind the Lines, provides a rare glimpse inside the war-ravaged country. He joins us this second half hour of our first hour to talk about the film, which airs as part of the PBS series Frontline tomorrow at 10:30 p.m. Ali Lambert, good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, and I should mention that you actually are a recipient of the Foreign Press Award of Journalist of the Year. Congratulations on that score. And this is an extraordinary film. You've done 25 documentaries, including for the BBC, but this is quite unlike anything you've done because here you are in the middle of a civil war on both sides. My first question to you, and I was quite taken with the footage here. I mean, you were shooting during actual bombardments and the aftermath of them and the like. How'd you win the trust of both sides?
Well, there's two things there. I mean, when you get to places, whenever you're making a documentary, whether it's with, families in America or in Britain, or whether it's with rebel fighters and regime loyalists, then it's really just winning people's trust. It's just about us being as honest as you can be and being as open with people about who you are and what you're trying to do and letting them tell their own stories. I think it's quite common when you're making a film that most people are desperate to speak and to be heard and to have their stories told. So when people are assured that's what you want to do, then that usually wins people's trust, just like when you meet anyone. I mean, the harder bit really on this was to see both sides of that conflict involved a very sort of lengthy sort of process. I had to make two trips into Syria, two separate trips. So the first one was going to the rebel side, which is relatively straightforward in that you can smuggle yourself across the border from Turkey and then travel down via Aleppo, and we went south. It took us a couple of days to get to this very specific valley in Idlib province. It's about an hour south if you're driving straight.
Forgive me, this is the Orontes River Valley you're talking about.
Yeah, it's called the Orontes River Valley, and it's a beautiful... it's a beautiful valley with the river running down the middle of it. And for generations, this place has been home to all kinds of different religions and ethnicities. But now, as the sort of conflict and as its third year, it's divided along sort of sectarian grounds. We have Alawite regime loyalists on one side who are protected by the government army. And they have Sunni rebels on the other side who are protecting... Sunni civilians and a large number of refugees. So it's become a kind of microcosm for the conflict and where it may go next.
Well, in fact, both the regime and the rebels are fighting to the death, fighting for martyrdom. It almost reminds me in some ways of Bosnia, because these were once neighbors and people who got along peacefully, but now they're divided by religion and ideology and so many other things.
Yeah, and it does feel like this is something that's been bubbling under the surface for a very long time. One of the people in the film is an old farmer called Mohammed Hamadeh, and he's in his late 60s and has lived there all his life. And he used a very interesting phrase. He said that the revolution kind of woke us up, he said. And by that he meant he'd woken up to realize that as he wasn't part of the elite in Syria and isn't part of the Alawite regime, he's a sort of second-class citizen, and he had to bribe people to get anything that he needed. He was often arrested at checkpoints for no reason. And so it's sort of it has awakened in people a sense of injustice and, in many cases, now a desire for retribution.
I think it was that same farmer, he's a sugar beet farmer, who said that there will be vendettas going on for 50 years.
That's right. And he does say that. It's a very dark statement, made all the worse by the fact that he's not some kind of young 20-year-old gun-toting hothead. He's a man who can look back on his life and in society quite clearly, and he really sees it in a very bleak way. And it poses a very big problem for Syria, because if the regime were to fall tomorrow, which it almost certainly won't, but if the regime were to fall, that in a way is only the beginning of the problem, because then you have to work how can this society make links with itself again and try and find any kind of national unity. So there's a whole set of problems that lie ahead, and that's before the fighting ever comes to an end. So it's a bleak prospect, really.
Well, there was another bleak thought that occurred to me, although I know you did yeoman journalistic work here. There is a sense that the rebels are... well, somewhat portrayed perhaps with sympathy because they're going out to fight. They only have 80 bullets. They're very clearly representing the fact that they're not getting any help from the West. And yet you have this young man that you particularly put the focus on, Ahmed, who by the end of the film we learn, and I'm not trying to give things away here, believe me, but is probably a candidate for Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I don't think it's overstating it to say he's a candidate for Al-Qaeda. I mean, Ahmed's journey in the film is very telling. I mean, when I first met him, you know, and when you first meet him in the film, he's a young, idealistic, rather wet behind the ears, freedom fighter. He's defected from the army, and he's grown a beard, and he looks a bit like a, you know, a bit of a terrorist. But he laughs at it. It's just a fashion. It's because everyone's sporting a beard these days. But by the end of the film, he's talking about fighting to the death. He's nearly killed himself. And, yeah, the last I heard, I've been in touch with him on Facebook, and he wants to join Jabhat al-Nusra, which I'm sure your listeners know is aligned with al-Qaeda. The thing is, I don't think he's really doing that from a political motivation. He's doing that because he genuinely feels unsupported by every other international and political element. So he will latch onto anything that gives him strength and courage and perhaps even ammunition. And that's very similar for a lot of men, a lot of young men across the country.
Do you, I mean, I'm going to put you on the spot here, I realize, but did you find yourself having more sympathy for the rebels in spite of, you know, the drifting toward Al-Qaeda or the perhaps even extremism that one finds in the rebel troops?
I mean, it wasn't that I found myself siding with them, but what I did sense was I could see how the radicalization of a certain kind of quarter of society actually made sense. You could see that a lot of these guys have been fighting for, you know, maybe 18 months. They've seen their friends getting killed, their family members getting killed. They've seen refugees getting killed, and no one is offering any kind of support for them. So when something comes along that offers them strength, I might not agree with the ideology of the people that they're wanting to join, but it does follow a certain kind of logic. And that's a very important thing for us and as a Western audience to try and understand. There's a logical progression to that, really. So I can totally understand it.
Well, you have the regime on the one hand wanting to essentially say Assad or no one, as they do, and then you have the rebels who are fighting to the death. And the division seems to be utterly complete in so many ways. And by the way, we're talking Ali Lambert, a documentary filmmaker who produced and directed Syria Behind the Lines, which will air on KQED9 on Tuesday, tomorrow at 10:30 p.m. as part of the PBS Frontline series. If you have some thoughts about the Syria conflict, if you would like to address some questions to the filmmaker who is here with us on ISDN line from London, we certainly welcome your involvement in the program, and you can contribute your voice to this program and your opinions as well as any questions you might have. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, and you can join us now at our toll-free number. Again, 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways that you can join the program. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. And our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. The footage is pretty dramatic, Ali Lambert, to say the least. I mean, you've got people running with children in their arms, the refugees who are being bombed by the Assad regime. You've got a young child yelling out that his grandparents are dead and woman yelling out her whole family is dead. I mean, this is just something that will really, I think, touch and grab and in some ways really electrify people who see this footage. It's stunning. And yet at the same time, it just points out the horror of this war.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't really expecting it to be as extreme as that. I mean, I think I'd spent months looking into the kind of
I'm sorry, we're not hearing you for some reason. That's a bad line. Yeah, we're going to try to get a let me get your calls on here. We'll try to get a better line with Ali Lambert, who, as I said, is with us from London. Let me go to Mountain View first. And Bob, you're on. Hi.
Hi. So it sounds like it's too little, too late. We waited too long, basically, and wondering what we're doing now to make up for it. I've heard that they're training Syrian forces out of country. I heard a Chris Matthews show. The Syrian forces don't want to leave. A little comment that from one of the reporters, the Syrian forces don't want to leave the theater. So to be trained, just a little sideline there. But it just looks like it's too little, too late before we waited to get involved and things deteriorated. So what are we doing now?
Yeah, well, that's the question. What are we doing now? You've got, as I said, one side saying they're fighting for a democratic Syria, but maybe allied with extremist groups, and you've got the other side that is pretty much and has consistently been essentially a tyranny, going back not only to stemming not only from the present Hafez Assad, but his father as well. Both Assad's father and son is what I meant to say. Let me bring another call on here. Before I do that, actually, I want to read a listener comment on our website. A listener says, I keep hearing of atrocities committed by the so-called rebels who are actually foreign Sunni extremists brought in by the USA. For instance, besides just killing Shiites indiscriminately, which is an everyday occurrence, a few months ago they killed a Christian man. They chopped him up and fed his body parts to dogs. This was in the news overseas, but not in the U.S. news, of course, since channels like Fox or CNN kowtow to the military-industrial complex. The USA has gone from ostensibly fighting terrorists to befriending and funding them. Or perhaps the USA always funded terrorists, as when the USA gave $1 billion to Osama bin Laden so he could fight the Soviets, or when he visited a U.S. military hospital just before 9/11. And that decidedly is a somewhat different point of view than what we were hearing previously from the other caller. Let me go to another call. And Frank, that's you. Good morning. Oops. We're having some problems with our phones here, obviously. Do we have Ali Lambert back on the line? All right. Let me go to another caller here. You're on. Good morning. I'm talking to a caller here, I believe.
Hello?
Yes. Hi. You're on the air.
I just wanted to say that I don't think anybody really knows what's going on in Syria. I haven't seen any evidence that there's any movement towards democracy. I seem to only see stories about extremism on both sides, and I don't necessarily agree with the regime that's there, but who are we to even intervene in that? And I'm glad there hasn't been major intervention, even though I'm sure there's been backroom funding and training in Jordan and possibly Lebanon, and I'm sure Turkey is involved in that through the UAE and Qatar. But I don't see any purpose to intervening there. It's just going to create extremism. If you topple Assad, just like you toppled Gaddafi, you're going to have extremism that's going to manifest, and U.S. citizens are going to end up dying, just like happened in Libya and Mali, and the Algerian gas station attack. All happened because the pressure exploded from Libya. He was keeping a strong hand on that. They used to say in the 80s that Arabs need a strong-handed dictator. Well, that seems to be true as a stereotypical and I don't think that's the right thing, but it seems to be the case.
Well, you make some telling points, and I thank you for them. In fact, as we go back and forth on this, of course, one has to realize that if you have a new regime, if you have a regime change like you do in Libya, you're not necessarily certain what you're going to get. And the same holds true, has held true for Egypt, and the same certainly holds true for Tunisia. And now we can say Syria, if there is a new regime. Let me go to Frank. Frank, we lost you there. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, my fault for calling from the car. I wanted to ask your guest whether he thought, in fact, that had there been significant aid from the West, or the U.S. in particular, whether it would have prevented the radicalization or the drift to the radical groups that actually have the weapons these guys want. Or are we arguing among ourselves and there really wouldn't have been a difference in what would have happened on the ground?
All right, it's a good question. I think we've reconnected with Ali Lambert. Ali, are you there? Ali Lambert, do we have you back?
Yes, I do apologize about that. Some technical gremlins over here in London.
Yeah, well, I think we've got a good line now, so I'm glad of it. But there are a number of questions that I'd like you to shed some light on. Last caller was just asking about whether there had been earlier help for the radical groups. It would have made a difference, or to what extent it might have made a difference. And another caller was saying how help even earlier or now might have just led to, let's say, a much more radical and Islamist type of regime.
Well, they're good questions. I mean, I can't... I think there's all sorts of possibilities the way things could have gone. The one thing that could have really changed things, I think, is the offer of... I mean, Turkey was putting an offer of trying to enforce a no-fly zone about 18 months ago, which didn't get through. That seems to me, as sort of having been there and seen what's happening there at the moment, to be a massive missed opportunity, because nothing's going to bring the regime to the negotiating table until they haven't got an advantage. And it's their air power that they can, you know, they're killing civilians every day. I mean, there are hundreds getting killed every day. And that really would make a dramatic difference, because although what we're looking at in the news at the moment is a large amount of people being killed, large amounts of munitions being dropped, there's a deadlock in Syria at the moment. Neither side is able to win, and neither side is going to lose. There are gains being made on both sides, and both sides are having losses, but nothing's really going to change the situation. I mean, in terms of, I hear your callers of concern about the rise of radical groups. And there are two issues there. One is that there is a growing number of foreign jihadist Islamic fighters who are coming into the country. But I do feel, from what I saw, that the bigger threat that is being faced in the long term is the radicalization of the Syrians themselves. And that is as a direct consequence of them feeling abandoned by the West. Ironically, you know, Russia and Iran and China to an extent, Saudi Arabia and Qatar are all involved in Syria at the moment. But the West is not taking any part of that. And whether it would change dramatically if it did take a stance, it's hard to say. But there's no outcome is looking like it's going to be particularly productive or particularly easy at this point.
Well, in addition to perhaps some real serious backlash and more extremism as a result of the West not lending help from the perspective particularly of the rebels, I was struck by just how cemented things have become. Now, by that, I mean, as you portray it, you know, you've got rebels who are talking about, some woman talking about wanting to drink Assad's blood, and then they have a picture of Assad that they step on and clean their feet on. And then you have a portrayal of these high school students who are soon to be drafted in Assad's army, and they can't wait to go and fight the rebels.
Yeah. I mean, it's entrenched is the word. It's just, and I wish it would have been fascinating to have gone to that area sort of 12 months ago, because it is interesting that in this particular area, and I was only in one very specific area, around a sort of 10-mile radius in Idlib, but this area had actually not really been drawn into the conflict until, I think, as late as May last year. There were tensions, but it was only when the demonstrations reached a peak that fighting began, and there was localized ethnic cleansing, and now the two sides have entrenched on you know, to each side of the valley. And it's interesting that they, although they see themselves as so fundamentally different and opposed to each other, there are real similarities to what they're saying. On one side, there's a Sunni fighter would say, look, I've only got two goals in life. It's either to free Syria or for me to be martyred. On the other side of the valley, there was a militiaman supportive of the regime who said very simply, you either win or you die. You know, that's happened in the last few months, that mindset. And, you know, as I said before, if the regime were to fall tomorrow, the big problem is going to be how do you try and reconcile these two sides, because they're not going to stop thinking like that overnight, regardless of whether the regime falls. Incredibly entrenched. That's exactly where it's at.
You were there, actually, during the time that both sides broke the UN-imposed truce.
Yeah, and I don't think either side really had any intention of keeping to that truce. By chance, I happened to be filming with a rebel commander at about 11 p.m., and the truce was due to come in about an hour's time. And there was no intention from his side that he was going to keep to the truce. But the reason why was quite interesting. It's not that he particularly, that rebel group or that military commander, it's not that he enjoys violence. But it's got to a point now, and this speaks to a bigger issue, is that the rebels cannot countenance having any kind of negotiation with President Assad. And there's a logic to that as well, in that Assad is responsible for the death of many, many of his own people, and the rebels have witnessed this fighting close up, and they've lost friends and relatives. The death toll is now over 70,000. It would take a sort of a Mandela figure to be able to accept and negotiate with a political leader, a president, who had that much blood on his hands. And the feeling is probably mutual on the regime side. The soldiers have seen many of their comrades die. Many of them are living in fear. There are kidnappings. So they are convinced on the regime side that this is foreign Sunni hordes who are determined to wipe them out. So,
In fact, recently, Bashar Assad just made a statement about how, I hadn't heard this since Vietnam, it's a domino effect in the Middle East. If indeed his regime should fall, there will be other regimes that will be taken over by extremists and of the al-Qaeda variety. That's what he's been saying all along.
Well, the thing is, he has been saying this all along. The real problem is that when he first started saying that, it wasn't really true. And it was not inevitable by any stretch. There are lots of things that could have been done. In a way, Assad's now got the war that he always wanted. He has now got foreign fighters involved, foreign governments involved, and the potential of huge turbulence all over the Middle East. And that suits the regime very, very well, because then it can dangle fear in front of, you know, a vast number of the population, and that is a motivating factor for them to support them. So there being al-Qaeda terrorists within Syria is, in a strange way, exactly what Assad would like. It totally supports his cause.
Yet when you talk about how entrenched things are, I use the word cemented. The fact is you've got the rebel commander on camera there saying, we all want to live in peace. We all desire to live in peace.
I think they all do want to live in peace, but they also, I think there's a growing sense day by day that the way to peace is through some kind of revenge. With every person that gets killed and every day that goes by, they are going to want to exact some kind of revenge before they can have peace. And it's peace on whose terms? You know, it's all very well for, say, Sunni rebels to say that we want a democracy, but they're saying that in the knowledge that the Sunnis hold a very large majority. Around 70% of the country are Sunnis. And the Alawites are aware of this. If there was a popular vote, then almost certainly Assad would lose power because he has not got the support of the majority. So yes, I think everyone wants peace, and everyone wants the, in a sense, things to go back to how they were. But what's happened now is a realization that the things how they were weren't all that great, and people have woken up from that, and they probably won't go back to sleep until that has been resolved in some way.
We're talking Ali Lambert, documentary filmmaker who actually was embedded in the British military in Iraq in 2003 and took film in Gaza, and has a film called Syria Behind the Lines, which airs on KQED9 on tomorrow night at 10:30. Let me bring another caller in. And Eric, that's you. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. There's so much to say, but I'm going to try to keep it as brief as possible. I mean, having been brought up in Lebanon and witnessed a civil war over there, I literally have no sympathy for the existing regime in Syria. They literally raped Lebanon for 30 years and atrocities and on. But the thing is I don't really think that supporting the rebels at this point is in the interest of the West or the United States. I think that if we lose Bashar al-Assad, we're going to lose any kind of moderation, especially any support for the Christians in Lebanon and in Syria. And unfortunately, you know, the people in Syria right now are in a situation where they're a little bit confused and really, you know, don't know which part to support. But the thing is that, you know, the best solution, in my view, is if we can keep Bashar al-Assad in there and somehow negotiate him cutting off ties with Hezbollah and Iran. That will be the best interest for everybody, to keep him in power and keep things at least not getting any worse. I think it might be a little too late, but that way we can kind of have a person that might be pro-West a little bit, because he really is much more secular than whoever's going to be taking over. and cutting off Iran and Hezbollah would be the main goals of the United States, and just keeping him in power.
Well, thank you for that call. It seems, sorry to editorialize here, but Ali Lambert, very unlikely. The ties with Iran and Hezbollah are very strong between Bashar Assad and in fact, they are there right now helping out. I wanted to also mention a news report that's come across my desk here. A suicide bomber just detonated a car packed with explosives earlier today in a busy residential and financial district of central Damascus, killing at least 15 people, setting cars and buildings on fire and sending plumes of black smoke rising in the capital. That's according to Syrian state-run media. But this explosion came as UN Chief Ban Ki-moon said inspectors were ready to deploy to Syria within 24 hours to investigate reports of chemical weapon attacks. But hadn't received permission from the Assad government. Every time you think it can't get worse, Ali Lambert, it seems to get worse.
Absolutely. And your caller, Eric, made an interesting point there. He said that, you know, if we were to hang on to Assad, then you know, if we were to lose Assad, he said, maybe we'd lose the moderation. Unfortunately, you know, we lost the moderation in the Assad regime nearly 2 years ago. That is the reality now, that there is very little chance that Assad holds any real place in the future of Syria. He can hang on, and he hangs on with the help of Iran and the help of Russia. But there, you know, and the burgeoning chaos that, you know, the suicide bomb in Damascus today, and there's constant airstrikes and suicide bombings. In a strange way, and it's sort of very counterintuitive, but in a strange way, this violence, as I said before, it sort of suits Assad. The chaos, in his mind, I think, it justifies his actions. It justifies keeping him in place. Like I said before, it's like kind of the war that he wants. It's having the chaos, because then in a chaotic situation, people are going to want the old order, because at least there was peace. And in a strange way, Eric, your caller, is just kind of goes for that. It's like, well, he might be bad, but maybe we can try and do business with him. I mean, that's precisely where I think the regime wants to position itself.
And I'm reading an email from a listener who says, it's amazing how the Obama administration is still playing wait and see to side with the winner rather than with the people who are in line with the momentous Arab rising against old regimes. The administration is making a strategic mistake in these sensitive zones for the world economy. That will conclude it. Ali Lambert, congratulations on outstanding work, and I appreciate very much your being with us here on Forum this morning.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Ali Lambert produced and directed Syria Behind the Lines. It airs on KQED9 on Tuesday, tomorrow night at 10:30, and it's part of PBS Frontline series. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, our repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our whole staff, Senior Editor Dan Zoll, producers Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Amanda Stupai is our engagement producer. Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.